The scripture reading for this morning is from Romans chapter Bibles, chapter 2, verses 17 through 29. I will be reading from the only inspired version, the ESV. There's a little bit of humor for some people who understand the context. But if you call yourself a Jew and rely on the law and boast in God and know his will and approve what is excellent because you are instructed from the law, and if you are sure that you yourself are a guide to the blind, a light to those who are in darkness, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of children, having in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth, you then who teach others, do you not teach yourself? While you preach against stealing, do you steal? You who say that one must not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who boast in the law, dishonor God by breaking the law. For as it is written, the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. For circumcision indeed is of value if you obey the law. But if you break the law, your circumcision becomes uncircumcision. So if a man who is uncircumcised keeps the precepts of the law, will not his uncircumcision be regarded as circumcision? Then he who is physically uncircumcised but keeps the law will condemn you who have the written code in circumcision but break the law. For no one is a Jew who is merely one outwardly, nor is circumcision outward and physical. But a Jew is one inwardly, and circumcision is a matter of the heart, by the Spirit, not by the letter. His praise is not from man, but from God. This is the word of the Lord.
So this morning, we are wrapping up the first major section in the book of Romans. And the book of Romans as a whole is about the good news. And you just heard Mike preach it from memory. The good news of Jesus Christ. That's what Romans is about. But in the first section of Romans, before getting to the good news, Paul gives us the bad news. And I would like to see if you guys know, what is the bad news? How have I been articulating? What's the phrase? What's the bad news? We all fall short. That's what I'm looking for. It's in your bulletin every week, so I figured you might be able to get it. The bad news is we all fall short. And what Paul does in Romans 1 through 3 is paint a very vivid picture of the bad news. The fact that we all fall short. And of course, his goal in those first three chapters is to get us to a point where we recognize that. We realize just how far we fall short so that we're ready then to hear the gospel, to hear the good news, and not only just hear it, but embrace it and receive it because we realize we need it so desperately. And so what he does in these first couple chapters is he goes through different categories of people that exist in the world and shows how in each case, every category of person falls short. So in chapter 1, he first goes after people we could call the unrighteous. He talks about the unrighteous. These are people who are obviously unrighteous, people who have obviously suppressed God's truth, who have exchanged worshiping God for worshiping created things, and who are living lives of obvious immorality, okay, the unrighteous. But then, beginning in chapter 2, he talks about not the obviously unrighteous, but the self-righteous. Okay, these are people that maybe live respectable, moral lives. They don't live lives that look obviously immoral, but they are pursuing self-righteousness, not out of gratitude for God, but they're trying to do things to justify their own lives. They're trying to do things that will make themselves feel acceptable and worthy before God. And we looked at one group of self-righteous people last week, and this week we'll look at another group. But I want to remind you where our tendency towards self-righteousness started. And I mentioned this last week, but if you weren't here, little review. It started all the way back at the fall with Adam and Eve. And you remember the story. Adam and Eve were created for this great relationship with God, and then they sinned. And when they sinned, when they broke God's command, the first thing they realized was that they were naked, right? They'd been naked the whole time, But they realized and they felt exposed for the first time because in their sin, they recognized their own brokenness, unworthiness, and so they felt exposed. And so what's the first thing they tried to do? To cover themselves up, right? You've got this really sad and kind of pathetic picture of taking fig leaves and trying to sew fig leaves together to try to cover this, so to make fig leaf clothes for themselves to cover and to hide from God. And really, ever since then, human beings have been trying to cover from God. And we've developed all these really sophisticated ways of doing it. But we do things to try to cover our fundamental sense of brokenness and inadequacy. And self-righteousness is one of the ways we try to cover and hide. Maybe if I can be good enough, maybe if I can do enough good stuff, maybe if I can be religious and moral enough, maybe that will cover up this deep sense of inadequacy that, if I'm honest, I know is deep in my heart. So that's this self-righteous picture. And I want to give you kind of a diagram of chapter 2. It's going to be a diagram day today. Hope you're excited about that. Okay, yeah. So two types of people in the world. Chapter 1, you've got the unrighteous, and they're in the gray, because they do obviously bad things, and so you can tell those people are dirty and bad. But then you've got a second group of people in chapter 2, which is the self-righteous. And they, at least to themselves, appear less gray. They feel like we're part of the better than the in crowd. And then you've got some boundary between them. These are boundary markers that the self-righteous would look at as things that would separate them from the obviously unrighteous. Okay, we could come up with what those are. They're probably things that self-righteous people do that the unrighteous don't do, or they're things that self-righteous people don't do that the unrighteous people do. Okay, I just said doo-doo, but that's all right. So in chapter 2, Paul goes on to talk about the self-righteous. And what he does is he talks about two attitudes, two postures that almost always go hand in hand with self-righteous people. First half of the chapter, he talks about this posture of judgmentalism. And that's what we looked at last week, okay? You could show it by an arrow. What self-righteous people do is they judge those who appear to them as less righteous. And that's sort of a way of making themselves feel better. And that's what we talked about last week, this posture of judgmentalism towards other people. But there's another posture that he talks about in these verses that Mike just read, and I'm going to call it externalism, okay? That's kind of a weird word. But what externalism does is it focuses on the boundary markers that divides us from the unrighteous. Externalism says, what are those external boundary markers that I can point to that make me feel like I'm in the righteous group and not in the unrighteous group? Because the reality is, we don't want to look internally. We don't want to look at our hearts, because the reality is, if we look in there, we're going to realize, gosh, there's a lot of messiness. There's a lot of mixed motivations, and that's tricky and messy. But if I can find some tangible things out there in my life, external things, realities, behaviors, practices that I can point to that make me feel, yes, I am in the righteous group. Okay, that's always the temptation in the self-righteous group, is towards judgmentalism on the one hand, and then externalism on the other hand, looking at these boundaries. So what I want to do this morning is talk about that posture of externalism. And first we'll look at the passage. We'll see, what did that look like for some of the Jews in Paul's day, which is what Paul addresses. And then let's look at, what might this look like for us 2,000 years later? All right, so let's look at the passage for a few minutes. What did this look like, this externalism look like in some of the Jews' lives in Paul's day? What he does is he goes after two key boundary markers, I'm going to call them, in first century Judaism. The first one is in the paragraph in verse 17. The second one is in the paragraph in verse 25 to the end of the chapter. So let's look at both of these in turn, and then we'll see what might this look like for us today. All right, what's the first external boundary marker? It's in that paragraph in verse 17. Take a look at the paragraph. See if you can figure out what it is. Take a sec. What's this external boundary marker that they pointed to? The law. Good. Yes, it's the fact that they had been given the law. Look at verse 17. You call yourselves Jew. You rely on the law. End of verse 17. Because you're instructed by the law. End of verse 18. End of verse 20. you have in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth. And then verse 23, you brag about the law. So the first boundary marker that self-righteous Jews would point to was the fact that they had been given the law by God. And in and of itself, that was a really good thing. The law was a good thing. I mean, the history of the giving of the law was a good thing. And I just want to remind you of this history, right? God had brought them out of slavery in Egypt, brought them into the wilderness, and then at Mount Sinai, he enters into this special relationship, this covenant with them, and he gives them his law. The Ten Commandments and the 600 plus other commands that were essentially his giving them, here's how I want you to live as my special people. And 2,000 years after Christ, we hear a word like law and commandment. We might have a negative association with words like that. But for them, they had a very positive association. God's law was a very good thing. And you read in the Old Testament, like some of the Psalms are basically love poems to the law. It says, God, your law is like, you know, it's like bread for our soul. Your law is a light unto our path, right? A lamp unto our feet, a light unto our path. Your commandments are sweeter than honey. And so the law, being given law, was a very good thing. And in some ways, it put them at a lot of advantages from the Gentiles who hadn't been given the law. Look at verse 17. Just look at some of the advantages they have. Verse 17, you call yourself a Jew, you rely on the law, and then you brag about your relationship with God. And one instance, the law gives you a special relationship with God. I mean, you know what he wants. What an advantage over people who don't know God's law. Look at verse 18. If you know his will and approve of what is superior because you're instructed by law. That's truth. If you have God's law, you know what he wants. You know how he wants you to live. You can discern the things in life that are best, that are most important to pursue. That's a huge advantage. Verse 19, if you're convinced that you're a guide for the blind, a light for those who are in dark, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of infants, that's the truth. You could be those things. If you have the law, you're not in the dark. You know the light of God's truth, and therefore you could be someone who could point and shine that light into other people's lives. So the law was a good thing in and of itself, but the problem was not the law. The problem was their attitude towards the law as first century. The problem was the posture that they took towards the law. And there's two words that kind of give that away in this paragraph. First, look at verse 17. The second phrase, if you, my translation says, if you rely on the law. And that word literally means to rest in, to lean on. And the attitude is this, you're relying on the fact that God gave you that law. You think that just by the fact that he gave you the law, that somehow puts you in the in crowd. You're leaning on that to say, we're God's people, we're acceptable in God's sight, because obviously we are, because he gave us the law. And then secondly, the other posture, not just to rely on it, but look at verse 23. They don't just rely, they do what with the law? They brag, they boast about it. This is the thing that gives them a sense of Jewish pride. We of all the people in the world were given the law. God didn't give it to anybody else. He gave it to us Jews, his chosen people. And so the problem is this attitude of self-righteousness and pride. We're God's special people. Of all the people in the world, he gave us his commands, and that makes us different and separates us. And we can count on the fact that we are acceptable to God by the very fact that he gave us the law. And so what Paul is doing first in this paragraph is exposing that self-righteous behavior. And what he's doing is he wants to take them from the external to the internal. And basically his argument is this, it's not merely possessing the law that makes you acceptable in God's sight. It's what? Doing the law. Yeah. It doesn't matter that you've been given law. It's doing the law. That's what makes a person acceptable in God's sight. Look at verse 21. You then who teach others, do you teach yourselves the same thing from the law? You who preach against stealing, do you steal? You who say that people shouldn't commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? He's saying, hey, you can preach the law and boast the law all you want, but do you actually practice what you're preaching to other people? Do you actually do the things the law requires? And the implication, of course, is no, you don't. And he mentions a couple things like adultery and stealing and robbing temples as examples of things that even Jewish people do. Now, not all Jewish people were doing that, but I think Paul is saying, these are just, I'm just giving you some examples, but I could mention examples that would hit every single one of you guys as things that you are actually doing. Or what I could do is take it from the external of adultery to the internal of lust, or the external of robbing to the internal of greed or envy, and every single one of you would fall short of that. And the Jews in Paul's day, especially the Pharisees, were really good at following the external commandments of the law. Things like observing the Sabbath, you know, resting on Saturday, or eating the right foods. But there are these internal things of greed, of pride, that they were not facing into. And so Paul is confronting that externalism and saying, that's not what it's about. It's about perfectly keeping the law. And by the way, none of you do that. You all fall short of that. So that's the first one. Let's look at the second one. The first boundary marker is the law in general. And then the second one in verse 25 should be pretty easy to figure out. What's the second boundary marker? Circumcision, yep. That's the other big one. If you're a first century Jew, it's the law and circumcision. Okay, those are the two boundary markers that define you as a Jew. And again, circumcision was a good and wonderful thing. It had a great history. This circumcision was actually given before the law at Mount Sinai. This was given from the very first Jew, Abraham, when God called Abraham to himself, entered into a relationship with him, and he said, I want to give you circumcision as a sign of this unique relationship that I have with you. This sign is going to mark you out from all the other peoples. You're my special chosen people, and we're going to have a special relationship, and circumcision is a physical sign that's to symbolize the spiritual relationship of love and trust that we have together. So circumcision itself was a great thing. The problem, of course, was their posture towards it. They took this external posture and they started relying on the mere fact of circumcision itself that made them right in God's sight, basically made them part of God's people. They said, of course we're God's people. We've been circumcised. By definition, that means we're God's people. We are accepted in his sight. And so Paul, again, with his second boundary marker, says, we got to take this from the external to the internal. And look at what he does in verse 25. First, he makes the exact same point he made with the law. Verse 25, circumcision has value if you observe the law. But if you break the law, you've become as though you had not been circumcised. Hey, it's not the external act. It's the keeping of the law that makes you righteous in God's sight. And then he says something that we all, 2,000 years later, go, yeah, of course. But to a Jew of his day, might sound pretty radical. If those who are not circumcised actually keep the law's requirements, they will they not be regarded as though they were circumcised? The one who is not circumcised physically and yet obeys the law will actually condemn you. Even though you have the written code and circumcision, but are a lawbreaker. Saying, if someone could not be circumcised, but actually keep the law, they would be a true Jew. And that would be radical to hear in Paul's day. And then he really gets at the heart of this, which is to say, it's not a matter of the external, but it's a matter of the heart. Look at verse 28, really key passage. A man is not a Jew if he is only one outwardly, nor is circumcision merely outward and physical. No, a man is a Jew if he is one inwardly, and circumcision is circumcision of the heart by the Spirit, not by the written code. Such a man's praise is not from men, but from God. Core theme of the New Testament. It's a matter of the heart. It's not a matter of the physical cutting of skin anymore. It's a matter of the spiritual cutting of the heart. God circumcising our hearts, meaning cutting them, softening them, reshaping them, transforming them so that they are more what he wants them to be. And that's not done by the written code. His Spirit has to do that in our lives. It's an internal thing that only God's Spirit can do. So not a physical circumcision, but it's an internal circumcision that matters. All right, so let's look at our diagram. You guys still with me? Is this working? Okay. So let's take it in the case of some first century Jews. What were the boundary markers? One, just having possession of the law. And two, circumcision. And that is what they took pride in. They said, we've got God's law. We've been circumcised. By definition, that's what marks us as God's people. That's what makes us know we're going to escape the judgment. That's what makes us know that we are approved in God's sight. And Paul says, it's not about those external realities. It's about internal realities. It's about, first off, actually doing the law, and it's about a circumcision of the heart. And here's the reality with those internal realities. Doing the law, none of you can do that perfectly. You have all fallen short, Paul is saying. And this circumcision of the heart, this changing of your heart, you can't even do that. For all your behavior and activity, you can't even change your own heart. Only God, through his Spirit, can do that. So, even you self-righteous Jews have to come to the conclusion that we all fall short. Okay, so there's the Jews in Paul's day. Now let's try to bring this, make this relevant for us today. Okay? What are the boundary markers for us? Probably not the fact that we have the law, probably not the fact that we've been circumcised. Last time I checked, that's not what most of you are relying on. But where do we see this, what I'm calling this self-righteous externalism? What are those external boundaries that we're tempted to rely on, okay? That when we think about what makes me feel accepted in God's sight, what are the things in my life that I point to, that I do, or that's just a part of my past, my history, that I say, ah, I'm accepted in God's sight because I do these things, or I don't do these things? Or what are the things, to use the other one, that we might brag about? What are the things we do that, if we're honest, we go, this kind of makes me, this fills me with a sense of pride. This makes me feel legitimate in God's sight because I do these things. Ready? Here's a couple options for you. Actually, before I start talking about, think about it for a second. Let me give you a second. Just think about it. What are the things in your life that you go, if I'm honest, this is what makes me feel acceptable, or this is something that can make me feel prideful, the fact that this is in my life, that I do these things. Okay, so here's a couple of them. I think obvious one is just Christian upbringing. I think that's something people are on. Of course I'm a Christian. I grew up in a Christian family. I went to a Christian school. I do Christian stuff. I grew up in the Christian culture. Of course I'm a Christian. I can look back on that and say, yeah, I'm accepted because I'm part of the culture. Okay, that's a boundary marker we might look at. Here's another one. Probably not in non-denominational churches, but in denominational churches, higher church, baptism might be a big one, right? Of course I'm a Christian. I got baptized. I'm a Christian. I'm acceptable in God's sight. Whether I got baptized as an infant, baptized as an adult, of course I'm a Christian. I got baptized. And I want to be really careful how I say this next one. I was thinking, what's the non-denominational version of baptism? It can be this, praying the prayer. And so I want to be careful. I want to say this right. Praying the prayer is a very good thing. I'm all for praying the prayer. I would encourage people to pray a prayer of receiving Christ, making him our Lord. But there could be a temptation in some people to simply rely on the mere fact that at some point they did this action of praying a prayer. I said these words of praying a prayer. I was at a camp and I walked up, or I was at a crusade and I walked up to the front, or something happened. And of course I'm a Christian, because sometime in my past I performed this behavior. And so I know I'm good. I'm good to go. Rather than realize it's not the behavior of praying the prayer. It's the heart change that God brings about through an experience like that. And it's a life that is now lived in relationship with God. That is what matters, not just the mere sign of an outward action of praying the prayer. Another one, obvious one, church attendance. Of course I'm a Christian. I go to church every week, right? Or if I'm in Southern California, of course I'm a Christian. I go to church every month, right? Of course I'm a Christian, right? And then what about things that maybe fill us with pride? And these are some of the big ones. Think about some of the spiritual disciplines, the religious stuff that we do that's good. It's good stuff in itself, but it's our posture can be wrong in it. What about things like quiet times, okay? Of course God accepts me. I have a quiet time every morning. I have a quiet time 3 times a week. I know I'm good with God because I do this thing consistently. I'm consistent with it. Maybe it's tithing. I give. There's a lot of people that don't give. I give. And that makes me feel like I'm a legitimate Christian. Fasting. Probably not as popular in our church, but that's another one that people could perform that says, look at how religious and how spiritual I am. I actually withhold food from myself and I fast. Now, some of you may not do any of those things, but there's the opposite one. There's the person who takes pride in the fact that they don't do any of those things, right? I'm not a legalistic Christian. You don't need to have a quiet time. You don't need to go to church. You don't need to pray all the time. And I don't do those things. And honestly, I take pride in the fact that I don't do those things because I've got an authentic relationship with Jesus that's not legalistic. That's another one. Bible knowledge, right? That was the Jews' issue. They had the law and they knew the law. And that can be our tendency. I know the scriptures. I study the scriptures. I can teach the scriptures. Of course I'm a Christian. And we forget that there are people who devote their lives, they're Bible scholars, and they don't even claim to have faith in Christ. So it's not the knowing of the word that counts. It's the doing of the word that counts. One more. Spiritual service in general. It could be serving in the church, going on a mission trip. You name it. This is the one, of course, that is the greatest temptation for those of us in full-time paid ministry, right? Of course I'm a Christian. Of course I'm accepted. I work at a church. Of course I'm a Christian. I heard someone give a talk last week that really hit me hard. He said, we forget that we can do ministry for all the wrong reasons. You know, you can do ministry out of a desire for recognition, out of a desire for praise and appreciation. And then he had this quote that just hit me. And here's the quote. It's possible to have a very big call and a very shrunken heart. And he's talking about those you know, pastors, parachurch leaders who have this big call, and yet somehow in the midst of that, they have this shrunken heart. And I had to face it. Is that something that I face? Do I have this big call? And it's easy to think that. I mean, I'm preaching through Romans right now, right? I mean, that's the call doesn't get any bigger than that. And yet I could preach Romans with a very shrunken heart. And I could preach some awesome sermons that you all would think, that was a great sermon. And I could preach all that and still have a shrunken heart where my heart in it is just for approval or praise or recognition or anything else. And so here's all these things that we might be tempted to rely on, that we might be tempted to boast in, that are good enough themselves, but they can be bad if that self-righteous posture creeps up in them. And what Paul's intent is, I think, in this passage, is basically to systematically dismantle all those boundary markers. And say, none of those are ways of ultimately being acceptable for God. There's only one way to be perfectly acceptable in the sight of a holy God. You know what it is? It's to perfectly follow the law. And none of you can do that. So, we all fall short. None of us are acceptable before a holy God. And that is the first part of Romans. I want to conclude this first part by reading something from chapter 3, but I want to say one thing before I move past these boundary marker issues. Because the question becomes, okay, if none of these make us acceptable, well, what do we do with these things? I mean, baptism, praying the prayer, spiritual disciplines. So do we leave them behind? What do we do with them? And the answer is, of course, we don't leave them behind. The issue is we just look at what is our posture as we do these things. And Mike Carpenter clearly didn't feel like he had enough time to talk today. So I'm going to actually give him an opportunity to talk through me. He's going to speak through me because I want to share another diagram that he actually created that I absolutely love that talks about the right posture we're supposed to have with these different spiritual disciplines that we go through. And the question is, do you view your spiritual disciplines as a checklist or as a window? Okay, that's the difference. So let me show you what I mean. Here's the one way we can look at our spiritual disciplines, those things I just mentioned. They can be checklists. These are things that I have to do because this is what good Christians do. All right, so my quiet time, is it every day or three times a week, whatever? I got to do my quiet time. Okay, great. Checked. I did my quiet time. Good. I'm good to go. Church attendance, haven't been to church all month. Okay, I'll go this Sunday. Boom, check that off the list. Giving, haven't given for a while. I know good Christians give, so I'm going to give. Check. Good. That's viewing spiritual disciplines as a checklist. What is the result of that? This is it. The result is we delight in ourselves. We conclude, I did it. I knocked off the checklist, right? And that can fill us with this subtle sense of pride. The other way to view it, this is according to Mike Carpenter, the only authorized version, what was it? What was that? Is to see our spiritual disciplines not as checklists, but as windows. And I think this is really clever. What you can do is you can put a cross in the middle of that check, and now it looks like a window, okay? And we view these things as windows. So I take a quiet time. I don't have to do a quiet time because that's what good Christians do. But a quiet time is a potential window. It's a space and time, maybe in the morning or at night, that I can use as a window through which to see God in my life, as a way of connecting with him, as a way of studying his word and learning more about him. In itself, it's nothing, but it can be a window that allows me to engage in my relationship with God. Church attendance. I could just show up to church and check it off the list, or I can see it as a window. This is my opportunity once a week to meet with God's family and to worship God corporately and to receive from God's word and to praise him. It's an opportunity, and I see it as that. Or giving, same thing. I could say, I'm supposed to give, check it off. Or giving is an opportunity to see God working in my heart and then to see God working in the world as I see what my gifts of money or of resources, how they're impacting the world. The result of this is not, I did it. The result of this is we delight in the Lord, and we say, I see you, God. These are opportunities to encounter you, to see you, to be ministered to by you. Isn't that cool? I like that. It's great. So I just wanted to say, these are all good. These boundary marks are all good things. It all just depends on what our posture is towards them. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to conclude this first section, and I want you to go to Romans chapter 3. I'm just going to spend a couple minutes as a conclusion of this first part. We're going to skip the first 8 verses because Paul actually goes back to that later on in Romans 9, so we won't be missing the themes that are grabbed there. But I want you to hear how Paul concludes this first section. I'm just going to warn you, this is dark. I mean, this is like devastating, a devastating remark on the human race. But we need to hear it. And this is how I'm going to end my time. I'm going to make a couple comments. And then we're going to end with a time of silence. So let me read to you verses 9 through 20. What shall we conclude then? Are we any better? We being Jews in this case. Are we any better? Not at all. We have already made the charge that Jews and Gentiles alike are all under sin. And then he strings together a bunch of Old Testament passages. As it is written, there is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands, no one who seeks God. All have turned away. They have together become worthless. There is no one who does good, not even one. Their throats are open graves. Their tongues practice deceit. The poison of vipers is on their lips. Their mouths are full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Ruin and misery mark their ways. In the way of peace they do not know. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Yikes. Now, we know that whatever the law says, he just read from the law, it says to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be silenced and the whole world held accountable to God. Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in his sight by observing the law. Rather, through the law, we become conscious of sin. Okay, his concluding point being, we all fall short. Jew and Gentile, unrighteous and self-righteous, we all fall short. And in this string of Old Testament quotes, he points out two fundamental realities about sin. The first is this: sin is universal, right? It applies to everybody. And you hear this phrase come up again and again. There's no one righteous, not even one. No one who understands, no one. All have turned away. To all that say, we have all fallen short. And not only is sin universal, but notice how he points out how comprehensive sin is. He says, sin is something that affects every part of our lives. Look at verse 11. It affects our minds. There's no one who understands. Look at verse 12. The end of verse 12, it affects our actions. There's no one who does good. And then verse 13, in a bunch of ways, it affects even our words. Their throats are up in graves, their tongue practice deceit. Our minds, our actions, our words. Every part of us has been affected by sin. And he leaves us with that. And then in verse 19, he leaves us with an image that I want to leave you guys with. An image of our situation apart from Christ. Let me read verse 19 again. We know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, here it is, so that every mouth may be silenced and the whole world held accountable to God. Here's the image he's trying to give us. The image is the image of a courtroom, okay? And we are in the defendant's box or whatever you call that. We're there because we are guilty of having broken laws. We've committed crimes. And God is the offended party and God is the judge. He's both of those together. And we are accountable, as it says, accountable to him as the judge. And then it says in verse 19, so that every mouth may be silenced. And here's the picture. The evidence in this trial against us has been so conclusive, so overwhelming, that when we stand to testify, there's nothing to say. We've just heard this such conclusive testimony that we stand and we realize, I have no defense. There's nothing I can say in my defense. And so we just stand there in silence, waiting to be judged. And Paul's goal in Romans 1 through 3 is that we would fully come to terms with that reality. That we would fully come to terms, that we'd quit denying it, we'd quit minimizing it, we'd quit trying to cover it up, we'd quit trying to muster up a defense, and we would accept that reality. And he doesn't do that to make us feel bad for its own right, but he does that, why? So that we will be ready to receive the solution to this problem, which is what we're going to hear about in the coming weeks. And here it is. It's God's wonderful gift of righteousness through Jesus Christ. That when we stood in that courtroom guilty and naked and exposed in our sin, that Jesus Christ intervened. And you heard Mike share it beautifully. That he went to the cross, and what he did on the cross was he paid the penalty for all our sins. He took on himself the sentence of our crimes, if I can put it that way. He paid off the judge. He paid everything that needed to take place. He bore the sentence for our crimes. And when we put our faith in him, we are now clothed, covered in his perfect righteousness. And what that means is we can stop trying to sow fig leaves of our lives to cover ourselves, because we have been perfectly covered in Christ's perfect righteousness. And so when the judge looks at us now, he sees us wrapped in these clothes that say something like, forever not guilty. Forever forgiven. Totally righteous in every possible way. And what the Christian life is all about is learning how to live in the freedom of that reality. Of knowing, I don't have to clean myself up. I don't have to sew something together. I don't have to muster up a defense. I could never do that. Christ has done what I can't possibly do. And I am forever forgiven, forever righteous. And now I am simply this object of God's approval and delight and joy and grace and love. And I receive all the privileges of being God's child. All because I am now covered with the righteousness of Jesus Christ. That is the gospel. But until we come to terms with our need, we're going to keep trying to cover ourselves. We're going to keep running around trying to legitimize our own lives rather than just stopping and going, ugh, I could never do anything, and thank you that I don't have to. So I thought a fitting way to conclude this section of Romans would be first to have a time of confession and then a time of celebration. And so what we're going to do is we're going to enter into a time of confession, and we're going to give you just a minute or two to spend some time in silence, just confessing, and then we'll do some singing, and the singing will celebrate who Christ is. So here's what I want to do. Just give you some space and have some time to confess. And then we're going to read together a corporate confession. Tim will guide us in that. But here's what I would encourage you to do. Give you a minute or two to confess two things. First, confess the ways you fall short, the ways you disobey God, the ways you go your own way. And in this past week, you've probably had a few fresh ones that you've committed. And so maybe those are the ones that come to mind. But whatever it is, whatever you want to bring to God, acknowledging, God, I am a sinner broken before you. Spend a minute confessing that. And then spend a minute confessing not just the sins, but confess the ways that you try to make up for your sin apart from Christ. Confess the boundary markers that you point to in your life that make you say, I'm acceptable before God because I do these things. Where are you tempted to put your pride in and your confidence in apart from Christ? Okay, so take some time to confess those two things, and then Tim will lead us in a time of corporate confession. So let me just open up this time if you want to bow your heads with me. Lord, as your family, we want to confess that if it were not for Christ, we would stand in your courtroom condemned and totally silenced by the overwhelming evidence against us. And we could try to muster up a defense, but it would be pointless and hopeless. And so we want to take some time right now, just in a fresh way this morning, to acknowledge the ways we fall short. And to acknowledge the ways we try to cover up for the ways we fall short. So we take some time as your people just to come to you and speak the truth about ourselves to you.